Hello, everyone, and welcome to another interview session with one of our experts at the Innovation and Creativity Summit 2017. Today, we're very happy to have Greg Sattell with us, who's one of the chief innovation experts in the field of understanding problems. He's the author of Mapping Innovation, and he runs an agency called Digital Tonto. Hello, Greg.
Hi, Nick. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Great to have you here. So, Greg, why don't you tell us about some of the things that really you find interesting on the topic of innovation and what your clients usually bring you in for?
Well, I think that usually the biggest problems that companies run into is that they have this kind of idealized view of innovation that it's this moment of epiphany or a eureka moment, and that what you need to do if you want to innovate, you need to completely change your company structure and hire different kinds of people who have purple hair and piercings or something. But most of the companies that are really innovative don't look like that at all. I mean, if that's your company culture, that you want a lot of very creative looking people running around, that's great. But if it's not, going and trying to change your culture into something that it isn't really going to help you. And I think that one of the biggest barriers to innovation is that there's so many myths, these sort of idealized stories about innovation. For instance, we hear a lot, one of the most popular stories of innovation is the one about Alexander Fleming, who came into his lab one day in 1928 and found that his petri dishes had been contaminated by a mold. And he decided to study the mold, and that's how he discovered penicillin. And that's the kind of great, you know, that's the kind of thing that makes a great story, that somebody can come in, can notice something, deliver an insight, and turn it into an impact. But if you look at what actually happened with penicillin, you'd quickly find that it didn't become commercially available until 1945.
That's quite a long wait.
From 1945, that's not in some sort of instant thing. And if you look a little bit closer, you find that actually when he published his results, they sat in a scientific journal for 10 years before anybody noticed. And the reason why nobody noticed is because what he discovered couldn't have cured anybody. What he discovered was a mold that secretes a juice that can kill bacteria in a petri dish. That wouldn't be any help at all curing a person. You can imagine going to a doctor's office and saying you feel a little bit under the weather and saying, I've been growing this mold in my back room for a couple of weeks. Why don't I squeeze some juice out of it and inject you with it? Besides that, there were some very, very other, very, very serious problems with the penicillin itself. You couldn't store it. You couldn't make it in any kind of quantity to cure lab mice. So that's why very few people took notice when he published his paper about penicillin. About 10 years later, another team entirely saw the potential in it, and they had a much wider diversity of skills. The two men who led the team, one was Howard Florey, who was a pathologist like Fleming was, but the other one was Ernst Chain, who was a biochemist. The exact type of guy you would need to figure out how to transfer the penicillin into a storable powder and how to make it in quantity. But even then, that only got penicillin to the point where they actually could test it on mice. So after those tests were successful, they sort of ran into a Ogall and needed to expand the effort further. They traveled to the U.S. where they, where other labs helped them identify a new strain of penicillin that was more potent, a new fermentation medium and process. And then finally, the U.S. government for the war effort basically ordered about two dozen pharmaceutical firms to produce penicillin. So what we, what was initially a story about one guy and one insight actually encompassed hundreds or even thousands of people to solve all the problems associated with penicillin, and still took 20 years. So
I think that's something that so many people, when they look at businesses, they ignore the fact that there are very, very few of these true lone wolf stories where one person actually was the catalyst for absolutely everything happening and being an absolute overnight sensation. In general, it takes, there might be one founder or one person who takes the end credit for something becoming successful, but there's so much time in between and so many people involved that a lot of people ignore that fact, and they just like the easy answer of one guy in a garage coming up with an idea and it instantly being successful.
Yeah, and I haven't found one example of one guy in a garage making anything successful. I mean, you see, probably the best example of that is someone like Steve Jobs, who really pushed forward the Macintosh. And that was, you know, that picture of him in 1984 is still iconic and almost personifies innovation. But the innovations that made the Macintosh such a breakthrough product were first, presented in 1968 by Douglas Engelbart. And then they were worked on at Xerox PARC for almost two decades. And what most people don't remember is that when the first Macintosh came out, it wasn't very useful. It was great for college students like me. I had one. It was great for writing papers. But when executives looked at it, they said, okay, that's a machine that does secretarial work. And it took more than a decade. It took really until the late 90s when you had enough applications and enough adoption that computers actually started making an impact on productivity statistics. So I think that's the main conception, is that innovation is something that happens very fast, or that innovation is about adapting. Once you begin adapting, almost by definition, you're already far behind. When you find the need to adapt, you're already losing. So it's much more important to prepare than adapt.
What do you mean by that, preparing?
Well, if you look at the history of innovations, it usually takes about 30 years to go from an initial discovery to a significant market impact. So that means that the next big thing is usually about 29 years old. By the time something gets to any kind of commercial viability, it's been around a long, long time. And if you look at Gartner's hype cycle, you know, you'll see things on the way left that aren't even in the public eye that are going to have a strong market impact 5 to 10 years from now. And you can rattle off a half a dozen of them: neuromorphic chips, quantum computing, 4D printing, the stuff that's not on most people's horizons, but
it all sounds like sci-fi right now.
Excuse me?
It sounds like sci-fi right now.
Yeah, in a sense it does. But if you take something like quantum computing, we don't really know what the full impact is going to be, but we know it's going to start to have an impact probably between 5 and 10 years. And we know that one of those impacts is going to be that it's going to render all current encryption protocols basically obsolete. So if your business has is involved in any transactions like selling products to customers or paying suppliers, that's something that's really going to affect your business. So what do you do? Well, if you wait 5 years and say and then say, okay, we're going to adapt and we're going to move fast, you're really not doing your business a service. I mean, this is highly visible right now. The government agencies in the US and around the world are already moving to quantum safe encryption. You can, to make your data quantum safe takes a couple of months and $100,000 or something like that. And those prices are going to come down very quickly, probably in the next 5 years. So this is something that you should really probably start thinking about now, about what your vulnerability is, what kind of market opportunities it might present, and start thinking about it. Most companies need to prepare, but they don't, because they're focused on the everyday business, taking care of customers, paying bills, running operations. But the companies that I studied in my book, Mapping Innovation, what they did is they had every single one of them, the one thing they had in common is that they had a systematic way of going out and identifying new problems to solve. And these took any number of forms. Experian, for example, set up a data labs unit, which would just go to clients and ask them what problems they were having and what problems they could solve. And then they would spend about 90 days and come back with a prototype. And if the client thought it was something valuable, they would co-create a solution around it, where Experian would keep the IP and then in many cases would be able to launch an entirely new business off of that solution. IBM, on the other hand, they talk to clients as well, but they're really looking for problems that will take them years or even decades to solve. Google, everybody's familiar with 20% time, but that what 20% time, the function it serves is at Google is really as a human-powered search engine for new problems. So there's all different sorts of ways that they do it. But I think that the companies that are, or the organizations that are continually successful at innovation isn't because they use one particular solution or another, but because they are constantly finding good problems.
I think that really feeds into something that your discussion ticked off in the back of my brain, which is, if you're saying that most innovations take about 30 years to become viable, then how do companies use that in the way they approach problems? Because if you're going to start right from the beginning and not see any benefit for 30 years, then that's quite a difficult sell to management. Is there a different way that they can approach this sort of problem finding and solution finding?
Well, It's 30 years from the initial discovery, which means that there was a lot of stuff done 29 years ago or 20 years ago that's becoming very immediate now. Very few companies invest in basic research, nor should they. Very few companies have that kind of decades-long timeline. And most of that type of research is done in the public sector anyway. That information is generally highly accessible. I mean, when you think about all the enormous amounts of research that are being done at universities and government labs around the world, most of it is published openly online. They have conferences about it. People know about it. So it's not that you're, from a private company's point of view, the point isn't that, oh, you should start now to have something in 30 years. The point is that thousands of people have been working on things for decades that you can make a business out of. And that's what I think really flips the conventional idea about innovation on its head. You don't need to be a genius coming up with path-breaking solutions. What you need to do is find a good problem.
And how do companies do that? How do they go out and become better at finding problems?
Well, the main thing is you have to be looking for them. And it really is just that simple. It makes it very hard to innovate when you're 100% focused on your daily business. I know when I was a CEO running businesses, that's what I was focused on. You also need a systematic way of saying, hey, what are new problems we can tackle? Usually those problems are identified by talking to customers. Some companies, startups, generally see a gap in the market. Some companies use market research. There are myriad number of ways to go out and identify new problems. But you need to be focused on doing it. And from there, once you are able to identify a problem that needs solving, whether this is something that you just see in your own business or that your customers are complaining about, or that you just see in your own life, the next step is to classify that problem and identify a strategy that's best placed to solve it. And that's what my book is really focused on, is about mapping the innovation space in order to match the right strategies to specific problems.
It's perfect. And what's the name of the book again?
Mapping Innovation.
Absolutely. So, Greg, that's all we've got time for in today's session. If our viewers see a link on the screen right now, that's going to take you through to Greg's webpage where you can find out more about Digital Tonto, more about the insights from Greg, and the link to the book, which is currently out, and all the other information you can want on finding out how to best approach problems in your own organization. Greg, it's been a pleasure having you.
Thanks very much, Nick.
Congratulations on being part of the Innovation and Creativity Summit. I'm sure that if you continue to watch the other expert interviews, you will experience an improvement in your capability to turn your ideas into something valuable. But don't forget, to get the very best experience and ensure you don't miss any of the priceless lessons, you should invest in yourself with the All Access Pass. Not only will this give you exclusive lifetime access to watch all the lessons whenever is best for you, you will also get all the interviews as downloadable audio files so you can learn on the go, full transcripts so you can read and analyze the great advice and tips, and exclusive bonuses not available to anyone else. Click the link below to get your All Access Pass now.